The following is a lecture entitled Coming World Changes, delivered by George Hunt Williamson, Research Coordinator of Shamanic Research Center. This organization publishes a printed quarterly bulletin containing timely and vital UFO news and reports of worldwide research in interstellar communication.
Pleasure to be in the city of Cleveland, and I'd like to thank the Coptic Center and all the other people who are responsible for making it possible for me to be here this evening. I'd also like to thank all of you who turned out so well for this meeting, because we couldn't have had the meeting without you being present. It's a great privilege and honor to speak to you on the subject of flying saucers. I feel that I have been very fortunate, because I have been a witness to two of the most outstanding happenings in the saucer field today. First of all, in August of 1952, I was present when our research group in northern Arizona made contact with the disks for flying saucers by radio shortwave or radio telegraphy. Then again, in the same year, November 1952, I was present with George Adamski on the desert near Desert Center, California, when he made his memorable meeting with the Venusians, and I took the plastic cast later that same day. I don't feel that two people came here this evening to hear my opinions, because they are the opinions of only one man. But I do feel that my experiences are important, because if flying saucers are coming from outer space, which I firmly believe that they are, then the fact of their coming to Earth is going to affect the life of every man, woman, and child in this region, and indeed affect the life of every individual in our world. I don't feel that it really matters very much whether you personally believe what I have to tell you this evening or not. I feel that we should let time be the judge of that. As Bacon said, truth is the daughter of time, not of authority. Truth will stand and will live. Falsity cannot stand and will die. Therefore, let time decide the truthfulness of my words to you this evening. I only hope that my experiences will awaken a sense of watchfulness within you, that you will look up to the stars and ponder many things. Now, for the benefit of those who haven't read my book or who haven't heard me speak before, very briefly, I would like to run down the various experiences and tell you how I became interested in flying saucers. Well, it was through studying the American Indians. Now, Indians sound like a far cry from flying saucers. In 1950 and 1951, I was in Minnesota working with the Chippewa Indians, gathering legends that had never been gathered before amongst these people. Many of these legends sounded like flying saucers, but I didn't pay any attention to them at the time. Going up to Minnesota, I had purchased Major Donald Kehoe's Flying Saucers Are Real. I never did read the book. I purchased it in the bus station on my way up to Minnesota. One week it was raining and I couldn't get out to do any field work, so I picked up the book and started to read it. Well, when I finished it, I thought, well, here's a man who's been in the aircraft field for many, many years, almost since its inception. After investigating it, and he was very skeptical. Of course, we know that there's certainly nothing wrong with good, healthy skepticism. After all, I was very, very skeptical, perhaps some of you are tonight, about flying saucers when I started in this investigation. But I felt, here's a man who has proven to himself and to many others that flying saucers are from outer space after his thorough investigation, spending many months on it. Then, all of a sudden, many of the legends that I had collected began to fall in place. I thought, well, this flying saucers certainly had been seen long before 1947. Been seen for centuries, evidently. Now, on further investigation, my wife helping me, we found that not only the Chippewas, but Indians all over America have the same legend. And on investigating still further, we found that so-called primitive peoples all over the world have stories that sound like flying saucers. In ancient Egypt, they called them fire circles. In India, flying boats. In America, they called them, the Chippewas, for instance, called them the Jinjin, or the wheels that rumble the earth, or flying wheels. The Navajos and Paiutes called them flying boats. Little people in the flying boats, and so on. Now, in every case, if any contact was made with these fire circles or flying saucers, why, they always gave words of wisdom and so on to the people. That is apparent in all the legends. Well, I came back to Arizona. A friend of mine from Winslow came down. I showed him some of my legends. I didn't say anything about saucers. Well, after he'd read a few, he said, well, what were you doing up there anyway? Sounds like flying saucers to me. They've been in the news quite a bit lately. I said, yes, it does sound like that, doesn't it? He said, I wonder what they are. And I said, well, I have no idea. As a man named Major Keyhole, he believes that they're from outer space. He said, do you believe that? And I said, well, I don't know. But I know that it's possible. We have to keep an open mind on it and study it from an objective standpoint. He said, well, I wonder if they're down here, why they must be, they're observing us. They have been for many years, and certainly if these legends are correct, they have been here a long time. I wonder if they'd be interested if we tried to contact them. And I wonder if anyone's made that attempt. And I said, well, I don't know that either. He said, how would we contact them? I said, well, surely you wouldn't go out on the hill and wave a handkerchief when one passes by. And you might wait a long time before one passed by. Then he suggested, well, maybe you could use radio. And I said, yes, if that would be possible. And he said, of course. He said, they wouldn't understand our languages or our code system. And I said, well, that's one thing that I can understand. Because certainly, they're more advanced than we are. We do not have spaceships, if there is intelligence in these ships. And if they have more intelligence, they can learn our language. Or if they are only as intelligent as we are, we can learn a new language fairly quickly. And they've been here for centuries, or even if they've only been here since 1947, surely they could learn our language. Now, they don't have to be told. We'll say that you people are all one tribe, and I'm an anthropologist coming in to study you. First of all, I'll try to find someone who's bilingual, that is, someone who speaks two languages, my own and yours. And then they can tell me what your words mean in my own language. But if there isn't anyone here who can understand me, and I can't understand any of you, I'll just have to sit and listen. Well, in about 6 months, I'll begin to understand what you're saying. That's how baby learns. As we get older, of course, it takes much longer to learn a new language. I found that out when I got in college. Surely these people, after monitoring our broadcasts and so on, could learn these languages. Now, as far as Mark Code is concerned, it's used every moment of every day all over the earth. And it's not any secret. So they could learn international Morse also. Well, we sort of dropped the subject. We weren't serious at all. We were just discussing the possibilities, you know, as you do sometimes when you are visiting. About 10 days later, he called me at work and he said, well, you know about the flying saucers. He said, we had success. And I said, well, what do you mean? I said, did you see one? He said, no, but he said, I mean about radio. And I said, oh, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm not kidding. And then I said, what most of you would say, it has to be true one way or the other. It has to be one thing or the other. I said, is it a hoax? He said, yes, we think it is a hoax. The radio man is certain that it is a hoax. I said, well, why don't you ask them to give some kind of proof so that you would know? I said, is it another amateur radio operator? He said, no, it's not another amateur because the signals are entirely too loud. We have to turn the volume almost completely down off. And he said, the radio man says that whatever it is, it's a big operation. It's not another amateur. Of course, then I really did get interested. I mean, outer space or not, something here was quite interesting. We had run on to something. So I said, why don't you have him ask for some kind of a signal? Well, he did. Now, he felt this way. Why would they contact him? After all, he asked me. He said, why don't they contact Dr. Einstein or the government? I'm just a nobody. Why would they be interested in me?
I said, well, how do you know they haven't contacted scientists from the government? Maybe they're interested in the people, too. We don't know. We didn't know about the atomic bomb till it blew up. So maybe the government is working with these people. We don't know. There are too many things to be answered here. So he said, well, I'll go along with that, all right. So we asked him for proof. They said, yes, yes, we'll be glad to give that proof. If you will get a glass, we will go by Solus at high time tomorrow. Now, we took that to mean that if we would get a telescope, they'd be by the sun at noon the next day. Well, of course, we didn't know what they meant by the sun, and we didn't have a telescope. Next day at noon, I went out and looked at the sun. Of course, the blazing sun, I could only look at it for a moment or two. I didn't see anything. But that evening at 5:45 on the newscast coming up from Phoenix, Arizona, my wife and I both heard that a large fleet of the so-called flying saucers had been sighted over the Yuma Air Force Base at noon, around noontime. My wife said, well, maybe that's it. And I said, no, there's nothing about the sun in there. Let's not jump to conclusions and try to prove this thing just because that happened. Just a coincidence. Well, the next day, the following day, after the newscast, the Los Angeles Times reported that Mount Wilson had reported to them that on the preceding day about noon, around the middle part of the day, very large sunspots had been sighted on the sun. Now, it's not unusual to see sunspots on the sun, but this was a period of declining sunspot activity. And instead of lasting the usual 2 week to 30 day period, they only lasted one day. They're completely gone the next day. Now, I can't tell you any more than that about that particular thing, and we still don't know if it was just coincidence or not. We never did find out. It may be just coincidence. We don't know. Now, the next thing, the radio man had a cousin of his come from back east, and he was contacting some other ham operator in the evening. Didn't mention saucers to his relative at all. When they heard a funny buzzing sound. So many of you who, perhaps some of you are ham operators here tonight, you know, sometimes they have a fluorescent tube on the outside on the antenna that flashes off and on during transmission. He said, would you go outside and see if that light's going? He said, there's something wrong here. I'm getting this buzzing sound. There's an interference. Well, the man went outside, and right away he said, good heavens, man, get out here. But when he went out, they saw this orange elliptical-shaped thing, or disc, swish off into the sky. So then he didn't want to say anything to the cousin at that time either, and he asked him, he said, what do you think that was? And he said, I think we just saw a flying saucer. He said, well, yes, I think so too. And then he broke down and told him about his radio work he was getting. Now the next thing, he asked me, he said, I'm really going to give this thing to work and prove whether it's true or not. He said, do you mind? And I said, no, because for one thing, my wife and I both were working for civil service then in the Veterans Administration. Some of you know who works for civil service that you accrue your sick leave. Well, my wife and I were getting sick at the same time. So the boss was getting suspicious. So I told him, listen, I don't want to fool around with this thing anymore. If there's nothing to it, why? Okay, but if there is something to it, well, I don't care much about the job either. I mean, I'm more interested in this. I take the chance. So he said, okay. Well, without telling any of us just what he was going to do, one night he was in his ham shack, which, by the way, is an old railroad car which is separated in half. In one end, he has all of his ham sending equipment and so on, receiving equipment. In the other end, he has his workbench. Now, he is a commercially licensed operator, not just an amateur, but he's commercially licensed and works with the Santa Fe Railroad in the radio shops. He's also repairs the police radios in their cars there in northern Arizona, and he's also a part-time engineer for one of the NBC stations. So he's pretty busy, plus all the neighbors bring in their broken-down TV sets and so on. So he's busy all the time, and he has the workshop on the other end. Well, this evening, without telling anyone, he had his back to about eight people in a ham set. And suddenly he decided to switch from 1 meter to the next. He asked a question on 40 meters and got an answer. And then very quickly switched to 160 meters, asked the question, and an answer came right back. Now, he told us about a week later, after he had a chance to think it through very thoroughly, that even if he had told the operator on the other end that he was going to switch, the man wouldn't have heard him in time to hear the question, and therefore couldn't have answered it. He said, it's fantastic to me. He's the kind of fellow that can only believe tubes and wires and what's right in his hand, you see, from Missouri. And he said, I just can't believe this, but I've got to accept what's happening. And we were glad that he wasn't the gullible type, because that way he would prove it, you see, one way or the other. Now, the next thing, he noticed a very peculiar pattern, something that was taking place, which is only sounds a little bit weird in one sense. He would notice if he was in the workshop away from his radio equipment that there would always be a pre-warning or a signal before the coach started coming in, giving him time to get to the set. But if he was at the set, there never was any pre-warning. He said, it seems to me that they know whether I'm at my radio equipment or not. Now, the next thing, we wanted to force their hand, so we asked them if they wouldn't land, make some kind of a landing rendezvous someplace, and they said, yes, we'll be glad to comply with that. Well, we let him make all the arrangements. He was the only one that knew where we were going, and we were to follow his car in the second car. Well, that evening, after arrangements had been made for the next day to go up into the mountains for this landing contact, why, the radio man's father-in-law came in unexpectedly from Tennessee. He's not a very old man. By the way, since then he's passed away. He wasn't a very old man. He was only in his 60s. But he had some sort of brain tumor. He was very senile. He would stumble. His balance was very poor. He had to be helped around all the time, just like a child. And he came out there to see a particular doctor. So the wife came out, and by the way, the transmitter was off, but the receiving set was on. He always left it on in case anything came in, but we had completed our transmission for the evening. So she came out and she said, what am I going to do about my father? He said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, the ladies are in there frying chicken and fixing sandwiches, and he thinks we're going on a picnic tomorrow. He said, we can't take him along. If he sees this thing land, he's liable to have a heart attack. Or if he is there, they may not land because of his condition or something. She said, I don't know, but we can't take him. He said, well, why don't we leave him? She said, I can't leave him alone because he might fall down and so on. Then, of course, in desperation, he was beginning to wonder what he was going to do with his father-in-law. He said, why don't we get someone to stay with him? I think we can get a friend. And he said, no, we can't do that because the doctors say that he must not be emotionally disturbed. And if he thinks we're going out without him, he thinks we're going on a picnic, and he will think that he's just not wanted. Well, for about an hour and 40 minutes, back and forth, we tried to decide what to do with the father-in-law. One minute we say we'll take him, the next minute we say we won't. When suddenly, cold began to come in on the receiver. Now, I got up and stood behind the radio man, looked over his shoulder, and believe me, I guess my hair wasn't standing on end. No one saw through that, but I certainly felt like it was when I saw what was coming in. First of all, he said, now about the father. Well, how did they know about the father? We never transmitted anything about the father. Then they diagnosed his case, said quite a bit about what was wrong with him and so on. And then they said something which I think is very significant, which really goes back even farther than the time of Job 4,000 years ago when he asked, if a man dies, shall he live again? Now, I'll give you what they said. I don't want to get my opinions in here tonight. As I told you, that's not very important. But I'll give you the experience, and you can relate it to your own experiences, and you can interpret it as you see fit. But this is what they said. Never fear the aged, for they can help when they are brought back into life again. Never fear the aged, for they can help when they are brought back into life again. Now the next day, as a confirmation of this thing, the next day, a little little 14-year-old boy from next door. He had been sleeping on a glass enclosed porch, the neighbor's house. It was a very warm, if you was in August. He came over the next day and asked the radio man, he said, "What in heaven's name was going on at your house last night?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" He thought it was funny because the kid, he would always be up late sending code, and the kid wouldn't think it was funny that he was on the air or anything. So he said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, I woke up at such and such a time." He said, "I looked at the clock and I noticed the time." And he told him what time that was. He said, "I thought I was dreaming, but I pinched myself and I knew I was awake." And he said, "I looked out the window and over at your house, above it, as far up as I could see in space, was a white tubular shaft of light. And it was going right down into the bedroom where your father-in-law is sleeping." The radio man knew that the kid had been seeing something. We did not see that light. But it was exactly the same time that we were getting the message coming in on the receiver about this old gentleman. Now, very briefly, I know you all wonder, well, what happened about this landing convict? Well, it didn't come off because we got lost in the mountains. He was supposed to wait at a fork in the road for us. We got separated. A logging truck came between us. We never did meet him. We wandered all over the mountains all day looking for him. We got back to town and he was sitting behind the mountain of chicken. He had all the food in his car. And he said, "Well, where were you?" And we said, "Well, where were you?" He said, "Well, I guess they're pretty disgusted with us. We didn't make it." And I said, "Well, let's go to the radio anyway." So we did, and they came in and said, "Our plans are to be changed. When all is ready, we will be contacted by a man." And then our contact did continue till February of 1953, on and off at various times, but we never received very much more. Then in November, on November 20th, 1952, my wife and I were with George Adamski. Now, we hadn't heard of George Adamski when we had our radio contact. But I picked up this book, The Coming of the Saucers, by Ray Palmer and Kenneth Arnold. In the back was a picture of George Adamski, some of his telescopic photographs of saucers. So I told Al, this fellow that worked with me on it, I said, "Al, you're going over to see your in-laws in Los Angeles before very long. Why don't you drop down? He's a pal of Mark, just a few miles from San Diego. Why don't you drop down and see this Adamski? Maybe he'd be interested in our radio work, because surely he's interested in saucers. He's been taking pictures." I didn't even tell my own dad. My father is a chief probation officer in northern Arizona, but I didn't tell him anything about it. I didn't tell my mother or any of our friends. So he said, "All right, I'll do that." Well, then later he met Adamski, and I met Adamski myself, and then we made arrangements sometime to go out in the desert. He said, "Can you get off work sometime?" And I said, "Well, that's getting to be a little bit strange, but I'll try." He called me up one time and he said, "Let's go out in the desert." He said, "I know out at near Desert Center, California." He said, "That's about halfway for you and halfway for me." And he said, "I know the saucers have been sighted out there fairly low to the ground at various times, and I'd like to get out. Maybe there's a chance of something." There wasn't any preliminary arrangements by radio or anything. As many people have said, we had made arrangements by radio that they would be there. Now, there wasn't any pre-arrangements at all. Nobody knew whether anything would show up or not. But I don't want to get in that tonight because I have many more important things to tell you. But I would like to say that the message, as Mr. Adamski writes it in his book, written with Desmond Leslie, "Flying Saucers Have Landed," is accurate. My wife and I both signed that affidavit, and we both read that manuscript before it was sent to the publisher. It is accurate as Mr. Adamski writes. We did see the large mothership. We did see the small ship as it hovered in the saddle. And we did observe the man through binoculars at a distance. We weren't too close, but we did observe it through binoculars. I was the first one, actually, to get up to the footprints and get a good look at them, and I made some casts of them. Now, when it comes down to it, I feel this way, and perhaps many of you do too, that have been reading about orange balls streaking through the sky and this and that, so high and going so fast and what have you. It all boils down to this, so what? Who cares whether somebody meets a man on the desert and speaks to a Venusian, or who cares whether somebody talks to talking by radio or not? As far as the world's concerned, it isn't very important, is it? When the novelty wears off, because nobody knows whether these men are telling the truth or not in the end anyway, and it's all forgotten. It is not really important to the individuals, perhaps, but not to anyone else. I came to that place. If this thing is true, what is it going to mean to the people of the world? Why are these people here? And what does it mean to each and every one of us? Now, during our radio contact, the saucer Archison said, and by the way, when I refer to they from now on, when I'm speaking of space visitors and so on, the other night I kept saying space intelligences, and someone after the lecture asked me if I meant space FBI. When I say they, I'm referring to these space visitors and coming in these saucers. They said that we asked, of course, about our atomic bombs, and they said that was a major concern to them, but that was not the main reason we were having all this weather trouble. But the main reason was that our entire solar system is moving into a new area of the universe, and that the cosmic ray bombardment is increasing, and that will cause many changes on the physical, mental, and spiritual level. Now, in anthropology and so on, I was mainly interested in the physical, because that is the thing that people can tie into. That's something that will prove it. To me, more important than meeting the Venusian or talking to saucers by radio was the predictions of these people, because if the predictions came true, then we had something to fact, you see, which to base on, and also things to give to you people so you can investigate for yourself, which I would advise you to do. I know it's pretty hard when you work all day and you come home at night and so on, you don't have time to investigate flying saucers. But the space visitors have said many times, look to nature for signs of the changes. And when they have said, look to nature for signs of the end, they do not mean the end of the world. They mean the end of the present age, because they say the world is not going to end as such. Look to nature for signs of the changes. Now, first of all, that was 2 years ago that I was received. So I thought the better thing these people said, I would wait and see if it was confirmed by science later. Now, very recently, Dr. Kurt Seitz of Syracuse University, working in Colorado in the mountains, discovered that the electron count had speeded up and the cosmic ray bombardment was terrific. Now, he was quite alarmed, but he wanted to confirm his findings still more, so he became an exchange teacher down in Brazil at near Sao Paulo, where he worked 18,000 feet up in the mountains. Now, he discovered again there that the cosmic ray bombardment had increased and that present theories would not account for it. That was released to a few scientific journals and then immediately hushed up. Again, along with the cosmic ray bombardment, Professor Veino Auer of Finland's Helsinki University, one of the world's foremost geographers, recently announced that the bacteria of Earth, or the bacteria which forms humus, was dying at a rapid rate because of increased cosmic ray bombardment, which means the nitrogen cycle would be completely interfered with, and all life on Earth would end. Eventually. It would take some time, but it would end. Now, as any high school student knows who's taken general science or biology, the nitrogen cycle is sort of a vicious cycle. It keeps life going here on Earth. First of all, we have the bacteria which produces the enzyme. The enzyme works on organic matter, which produces humus. Of course, plants live from the humus, and we live off the plants and the animals who get their life from that. Free nitrogen we cannot take from the atmosphere. We must depend upon the plant life and so on. Now, if the bacteria would die because of the increased cosmic ray bombardment, you could see what would happen. No enzymes to work in the organic matter, no organic matter in the humus, and so on, and it goes around in a circle again. Now, many of you have probably read Major Donald Kehoe's book, Flying Saucers from Outer Space, his second book, the recent one. In there, he talks about the red spray cases. Now, the red spray cases were bombs that, which he called bombs, rainy bombs, and in a sense, they were bombs too, but of a beneficial type. Bombs that exploded near the airport near Albuquerque, New Mexico, three nights in a row at the same time, and alarmed many people. Now, Space says it is said that those bombs were not being sent to test out any conditions where they would invade later. The sources, I might add, are not hostile. The idea is absolutely ridiculous. In the first place, if they've been coming here since 47 or even for centuries, as is known now, why didn't they take over when we had bows and arrows? Why did they wait till we had atomic weapons? That doesn't make sense. Now, people that will concede that life is on Mars say, well, that Mars is a dying world and there's no water up there, so the Martians are looking at our world like it's some sort of a big water bucket, thirstily, and they're going to come down here and take over. In the first place, in answer to that, they have said that there are quadrillions of worlds in space, much better than this one. We have contaminated this one in the second place. Why would they want it? They don't have to move in where there are people. There are plenty of other places. They are not coming here to invade or take over our planet. Now, the spray cases have been received were not satisfactory. I mean, the spray bombs were not satisfactory, so they developed a tube-like device to rejuvenate the soil in certain areas. Now, some of you perhaps have heard, 6 to 8 months ago, the stories of the red blind telephone poles, which were over Illinois, Wisconsin, some in Michigan. These things were noticed usually in the late hours of the morning, or early hours, I should say, of the morning, between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. Truck drivers noticed them mainly because they're on the roads at that time. Several of them would kind of go along, I suppose, simply too, and they'd see this glowing red thing, or if they were seen higher up, they were blue-green, going along in front of them. And they would flop over and feel. Some truck drivers related that they had suddenly put on their brakes and were quite alarmed, and they saw these things slide over noiselessly into fields at a distance or something. A space visitors say that is a tube-like device that is filled with highly nutritious material and other types of material that is now being tested on and going to be used to rejuvenate certain areas because of bacteria death and because of the cosmic wave bombardment. Now, people ask the question, and this is a very good one, so I'm going to answer it before someone asks it. That is, if our entire solar system is moving into a new area of the universe, why aren't the people on Mars and the other places being affected? Why is just Earth being affected? The reason for that is the Earth has an unstable magnetic field. I'm not going to go into all of that tonight. First place, I'm not a physicist, and I don't know very much about it. But the Earth has an unstable magnetic field proven by the fact that our magnetic north is not the same as true north and so on. Therefore, only those with unstable fields will be affected by this bombardment. Mars partially, and Earth much more so. Articles have come out recently by scientists. They say the Earth is now tipsy because of various conditions at the poles. And some physicists are quite alarmed about that also. Now, these bombs, rejuvenation devices, are said to go into the ground and dissolve in about an hour. They have said that the proof of this will be when certain farmers and others going by open fields, recently plowed and so on, they will notice a slight red glare, so a red tinge to the ground when the sunlight hits it in a certain way. So you can be on the lookout for that sort of thing. Now, the next phenomenon, which I think is perhaps the most exciting and most interesting of all, connected with the saucers. To me, they're even more interesting than the saucers themselves. And that is the fireball. Now, these flying telephone poles I just talked about are not in the fireball class. Actually, there are three types of fireballs, and now there's a new one being manifested in Washington, which I don't want to get into that either. A lot of things just going aside here, but time is limited, and I want to give you as much as possible. There are three types of fireballs. The third type I'm not going to discuss this evening because it does not pertain to my talk. We don't have time to. Mainly these are the names. The ones I'm going to mention are the most interesting. First of all, the number one first fireball is a nullifier. A Dr. Lincoln LaPosh in New Mexico, one of the world's authorities on meteors and so on, was asked his opinion when the fireballs first started occurring, the green fireballs, in the southwestern part of the United States. Many scientists said they were meteors. Of course, there, a lot of those were scientists who had never seen the green fireball. In that respect, they had the advantage of total ignorance because they'd never seen one. They just said it's a meteor. Of course, they didn't know. The same thing with a flying saucer. Scientists who say that they're meteors, they may have never seen a flying saucer, but then they would know it wasn't a meteor. But anyway, Dr. LaPosh said, no, they are not meteors because these things explode silently. Usually meteors are noisy freight trains. These things are green. Meteors are never green. And these things leave a copper residue in the atmosphere after they explode. Meteors contain no copper. Now, sometimes they do, but it's such a small percentage that it's to be negligible. Very little copper, if any. These things appear to be all copper. Now, these are set off. They noticed it. LaPosh and other scientists noticed that there will always be many fireballs, green fireballs, sighted after atomic explosions. So this particular type 1 fireball is set off to nullify our atmosphere from a certain amount of deadly radioactivity in the atmosphere of Earth. Now the second type, which is the most important to our talk this evening, is a remote control device. Now this is of such a startling nature. I know it was to me, and then I did a little research on it in history, by the way, which I'm going to give you a few of these facts. I think they're quite interesting. First of all, space visitors have said that this particular fireball is composed of crystalline copper. Now, we thought at first that they meant crystal and copper, but it's not crystal and copper, it's crystalline copper. Our remote control devices always have an intelligence or a man behind them, a mind behind them somewhere. They can't operate unless they do. These things, besides having an intelligence behind them, have an intelligence within them. Now, it's difficult for us to think of a crystal that can think. However, very recently, scientists have made the announcement that very shortly, well, by shortly, within a few years, we will not have these tapes running this way to record anything. Because they've discovered that a crystal, an inch square, will record and hold 2,000 items of information. 2,000 items of information. You could carry around many, many hours of tape recording, just something not much bigger than a cube of crystal. I mean, a cube of sugar. So we're getting very close to these things ourselves. These people are just a jump ahead of us, that's all. Now, I don't feel that there's anything supernatural to the fossils. And of course, to me, there's nothing supernatural in the universe, because supernatural implies beyond nature. And you can't have anything beyond nature. Therefore, so-called spiritual manifestations, mental or any of the other physical, they're all one. Science and religion are really one. It's only in our own mind that we separate them. They never were separated, actually. Someone one time down here in Cincinnati asked me, they said, well, why in heaven's name would anyone want to combine science and religion? Well, I answered that by saying, there is no religion higher than truth. Now, science has some of that religion, and religion has, science has some of that truth, and religion has some of that truth. Then that truth will not contradict itself. It cannot. I feel that we must show the religionists the science of religion, and the scientists the religion of science. For many years, religion has been on the extreme right and science on the extreme left, and they're coming closer and closer together all the time. These new discoveries, every day, bring them closer and closer together. Now, these fireballs, by the way, you remember the fireball that came down and went around Lieutenant Gorman's plane in North Dakota. He said that he called it an intelligent light that seemed to follow his plane around. Well, now, they do not contain any little men 2 inches in height or anything like that. They are remote control devices. They are sent out telepathically from the mothership, or not the mothership, but a space laboratory. Now, the various occupants of the saucers, they say, will have a fireball or two, just as we might have a mascot, a dog or something. And these things are sent out telepathically to the area that they once studied. Now, I believe sincerely that the way they obtained what we were saying in Arizona was by one of these remote controlled scanners. That they dropped down low enough to pick up our conversation and perhaps televise it back to the ship. That would be, I don't know that, but I mean, that would be one way that they could have learned what we were saying. Now, not only do these fireballs pick up voices or anything, they could be recording everything I'm saying now, and they could also televise back this entire group here. By the way, the thing doesn't have to be in the room. It's some kind of an X-ray-like device which can go right on through the walls and so on and pick up whatever they want to. Not only do they grasp, but they are going over the fault lines of Earth, which I'm going to show you a map in just a few moments, and they are constantly patrolling these fault lines, sending back information on how these things are taking the stress and strain from cosmic ray bombardment, and secondarily because of the atomic bomb. Now, what about copper and crystal? I know a few of you here know about this, so I'm just going to throw it in because there's some very interesting things in history about copper and crystal. First of all, copper is the most common metal on Earth. Most easily obtainable, common. That's naturally proven by the fact that with the Earth, when it went through a metal stage, it first went through a copper stage, and then to bronze, and then to iron, and so on, and then to steel. Now, the ancient Egyptians have a symbol, or they wore a cross, which was the Ankh, or the symbol of everlasting or eternal life. This Ankh was an oval with a paw cross and a T cross underneath it, which stood for the male and female principles, or negative, positive, and so on. Now, this cross was later used, the symbol, mind you, of eternal life or everlasting life for the Egyptians, was later used by the medieval alchemists as the symbol for copper.
Interesting that they would use a symbol that stood for everlasting life for copper. Then, even in astronomical science today, the symbol for Venus is the Egyptian Ankh.
The astronomical sign for Venus. Also, another connection here, we get the Ankh, symbolized by Venus, symbolized by the Ankh. Also, Venus is symbolized by copper. That's the symbolic metal of Venus, is copper. Now, many of you know or have seen drawings and so on of ancient people with a band around their head and in the center a gem or something. Now, that was not placed there for artistic decoration or ornamentation, but was placed there for a definite purpose. The stone in the center many times was lapis lazuli, which is crystalline copper or a corrosive product of copper, again. And that was placed over the pineal gland amongst ancient people to stimulate telepathy. Now, some people may laugh, but many of our upstanding American universities have been experimenting with telepathy, such as Duke University, Dr. Ryan's work, and so on, experimenting with extrasensory perception, and they have discovered that when a subject in a telepathic experiment has a piece of lapis lazuli stone taped over the pineal gland here on the forehead, the telepathic ability increases. They notice that to a marked extent, to a marked degree. If that stone is taped over the thyroid or other glands, it sort of short circuits the system and the telepathic ability decreases. That has been proven by science. So again, we find these peculiar qualities of copper. Also, I can give you many examples, which I'm not going to take time now. You go back into legends and mythology. Many of the ancients would place pieces of copper and later copper coins when it was used in coining. They would place it over the eyes of a dead person because the copper, they believed some quality of the copper would have that person's eyes would open again and they would have immortal life. It was symbolic of everlasting life, you see. Now, Dr. Lyne, in his telepathic experiment at Duke University, uses a copper cage, which he places over the subject when they're experimenting. So again, copper is being used. Now, space visitors say that copper possesses a dimensional quality that no other metal on Earth possesses. Whatever that means, I don't know. You can take it for what it's worth. But it possesses some sort of a dimensional quality that other metals do not possess. Now, in combination with crystal, you all know the legends and the stories about crystal bowls, which are even continuing today. It's believed that a person can get glimpses of the past and the future through a crystal ball and so on. Now, space visitors say that originally the crystal ball, was brought here from outer space, but it was not a solid ball of crystal. It was composed of 9 to 13 segments which were fitted together, which on scientific principles caused diffraction of light and so on, and through that, sometimes they were able to read the past of a particular object by scientific means, or they could even look into the future. How they did it, of course, I don't know. Now, many years ago, some of these crystal balls were found when they were excavating around the Great Pyramid. But because no crystal balls were known from any Egyptian period, they thought that they were something modern and threw them out. Now, these people say, and you can take this for what it's worth, that Nostradamus possessed one of the last of these balls and was able to make his predictions because of it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I tell you because I think it's rather interesting. So we know crystal and copper, the lore of crystal and copper is very rich in our own historical records and legends and so on. Now, faith doesn't say that this particular object, when it goes down, it picks up anything which is around it. They say that copper has the ability to record and retain any information or anything with which it comes in contact. It has that peculiar quality. Therefore, it picks up this material, it evaluates it, and as you send light through a prism, or a crystal again, which turns goes into the spectrum, which goes out in molecular form, the same thing happens in the crystalline fireball. The particular any information is televised back in full color and so on, and is sent through this crystal and is sent out in molecular form and is picked up in the craft. Now, these things are sent over a fault line, and any information they pick up there is sent back to be evaluated in the laboratory. Now, if we can have that picture, Al, please.
Now, this is a map of the major fault lines of the world. These dark lines are the fault lines. Now, a fault line is a line of ridges in the Earth's crust, along which volcanoes are found, like Vesuvius in Italy, and some of the Alaskan volcanoes and volcanoes in the Pacific. These are lines of weakness, big cracks in the Earth's surface. Many of you have heard of the San Andreas fault line. It caused all of the earthquakes, the disasters, and so on out there several months ago in California. The San Andreas fault run, well, actually it's clear over here, but it extends down into Canada, Alaska, Canada, and down through Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and down into Mexico. Now, the fireballs are sent out over these things to space laboratories nightly, they say, in order to determine the condition of these fault lines. Now, as I said before, atomic bombs, they say, are not causing all of our weather conditions. It's the new cosmic vibrations or the new intense vibrations that we're going into in this new area of the solar system. Atomic bombs only accentuate an already weakened condition. Like you have a crack in the ground and you jump up and down on it, why is it going to give or make a bigger crack or something? Unfortunately, our government, because they had to pick an area in the country where the population was small in order to experiment with the atomic bombs. They couldn't do it outside of Cleveland or anything.
But unfortunately, perhaps unknown to them, they picked an area in New Mexico and Nevada both where one of the world's major fault lines goes right through it. So the atomic bombs experimented with there were set off right over the fault line. Now, recently, Russia has been experimenting with atomic bombs at the North Pole, near the polar vent areas of Earth. That could also be causing some of the funny weather, but it's not wholly responsible for it. Another thing I'd like to add here, these people say that we have not set off a hydrogen bomb, nor will we. What is called hydrogen is not hydrogen, actually, although this is a technical small line, but it's tritium and deuterium. There are two isotopes of hydrogen with a different atomic weight. Of course, the tritium and deuterium are hydrogen too, in a sense. But anyway, if we use pure hydrogen, we would destroy this planet. They say that that already happened with the planet between Mars and Jupiter, now known as the asteroid belt, which the ancients referred to as Lucifer. But that planet was destroyed by hydrogen bombs. Now, I talk with some friends of mine, they say, no, that doesn't fit because astronomy knows that those asteroids came about by a cold collision of some type. However, now some new theories coming out in astronomy tend to prove that the collision was caused by thermal action, radioactivity, or by, it could very easily be hydrogen power. These people say that they swore a covenant at that time in a confederation of people, or an interplanetary brotherhood, that never again would they allow that to take place. Therefore, they say that they themselves, although they cannot interfere to a great degree, nevertheless, they will interfere that much and not allow this planet to be destroyed. Now, why are they checking these fault lines? The reason for that is, if there is a major disaster in some areas, they will evacuate. Not to another planet, necessarily, but they will pick people up and put them in safe areas, or they will keep them up in the ships until the disaster is over. They promise that they will do that. Now, I don't like to be a prophet of doom or gloom. That's why I tell you they say the world isn't going to end. I don't think we have to worry too much about local disasters. They say that local disasters will increase. Earthquakes will increase. They have in the last 2 years. They predicted 2 years ago they would get worse, and they have been. Tidal waves, dust storms, earthquakes, all those sort of things. For instance, let me give you just a very quick rundown briefly. The volcanoes that have been extinct since the history of man. And they have now been active up here in Alaska, throwing ash and other volcanic residue on cities. That was reported to me some months ago. Also, you remember the Ionian Island disaster in the Mediterranean, where over 1,200 people died in Greece and Ireland. You'll notice that the Ionian Islands are directly over three of the world's major fault lines, where those three converge, so that could be a very dangerous area. Now, as the state surgeon has said, look to nature for signs. You see, we can look to nature herself and see the portent of things to come. We can see what's coming. A few days after the Ionian disaster, the Azores Islands had a disaster, and you'll notice they are over an area where three major fault lines converge. Now, the world is covered with minor fault lines which extend out, just going all over here like a road map. But these are the largest ones, the major ones. This work was done about 20 years ago by a man named Commander John C. Cole. And very little has been done on it since then. Now, we do not have the ability, recently some work has been done on it, but we do not have the ability in this world to predict when a volcano will blow itself or when we'll have an earthquake. But recently, scientists now are able within a few hours to determine when there will be an earthquake. But these fireballs and these people being much more advanced than we are able to determine the extent of these fault lines and the extent of the disaster that may occur there. You probably remember in the news that many witnesses before the Algerian quake recently, when several hundred people died, as you know, the Algerian quake area is right on one of the world's major fault lines, right here in northern Africa. Now, just before that happened, some witnesses noticed a large exploding light, a silent exploding light in the sky that gave off a glow. just before the quake. That was one of the fireballs that was detonated after its instruments destroyed and had relayed the information back to the space laboratory. On the east coast, where hurricanes have been hitting and so on, witnesses have seen exploding lights just before the fury of the storm hit. Again, they are measuring the intensity of the storm and so on. There are many other cases that I can give you, but I wanted you to see this map because a friend of mine did some checking in the south and going across the country, and he noticed that where these lines exist, more stars have been seen and more fireballs. Now, in 1952, in the early part of 52, you probably, some of you remember, the largest floating light over Seattle startled thousands of people, ran out of their homes. It shook the city. It's still a great mystery. Well, that was another fireball floating over, because Seattle is also over an area where three of the world's major fault lines converge. They're not too many of those places. But Seattle is directly over there, and that would be a very dangerous area. Now, recently, fireballs have been sighted there, actually by the hundreds. Power line employees say that, the power employees say that the funny things are happening to their equipment in the power houses. And if they look outside when there's funny stuff going on, they see fireballs across the passing overhead. One of the reasons that saucers have landed in the desert and in these out-of-the-way places is because if they come low over a city like Cleveland, they would cause disaster with the electronic equipment and electrical equipment. And they don't want to do that because of hospitals and other emergency places that would, of course, go on the fifth or something because of it. But they are coming down low here to do some studying on this particular fault. Watch the San Andreas Fault in the near future. I don't say how long, I don't know myself, but there's going to be some trouble out here on the west coast. A lot of people say, well, maybe you say the world isn't going to end, but it sounds like a lot of doom and gloom to me because of these disasters. Well, you people are still well and healthy. Nothing, because of the Algerian quake, here didn't hurt you. And after all, death is given every moment. We might step out here tonight to be run over by a car. Someone may drop dead of a heart attack before this meeting's over. It can happen anytime. We all know that. We live with it constantly. So we don't have to worry about that, whether we're going to die in some deluge or some horrible flood or something. Because these people say truly, your world is not going to end, and man has only the good and beautiful to inherit in the new ages to come. This is what man has been waiting for on earth. And these people are here to see us through that. You will turn that off now, please, Alan.
Just a few other things there before we give you 4 or 5 minutes to get to later, and then we'll have a question and answer period. And then I'm going to finish up with the mental and spiritual changes. I mainly wanted to give you the physical changes that are taking place, and you can notice these things in your own newspapers. Another thing, the polar caps are melting. That's the reason for the oceans rising. The salt and sea in California recently has risen 7 to 11 feet, and salt water has gotten into the crop areas and so on. That's the reason for the Holland and Belgium floods here last year and so on. The reason for the floods in Italy right now. And those things will continue. Now the entire weather of Earth is warming up. I talked to a weatherman in the United States Weather Bureau in Arizona. He said, Rick, it's not strange that the weather is changing, because we know from scientific studies that the Earth goes through cycles. But there are very many changes. Because the strange thing is, actually, according to the cycle, you should now be going into a colder period. But instead, you're getting warmer all the time. That's the strange thing. Not getting colder, but getting warmer. That's why the polar caps are melting. That's why we're having these floods. That's why all of the terrific avalanches in Europe. You know, we've been hearing a lot about that. Villages in the mountains being covered up by ice and so on. That's why the ice flows in the northern European harbors have got so much attention in the newspapers. Ships couldn't get in, ships couldn't get out, and so on. That's another indication of the weather warming up. Physicists now know that some of them have been in Washington, even trying to get a congressional hearing, saying that conditions are very bad, but it's possible the Earth may slip and may slip on its axis and so on because of the conditions of the pole. Now, we know that the poles at one time were tropical because fossil palm fronds and other tropical life is found fossilized at the pole, both north and south. Now, I don't believe that that's going to happen if it's going to destroy all civilization, of course. But I don't believe that that's going to happen. Nevertheless, there is a tendency for that the Earth is in a wobbly, unstable condition. I feel that the government may need the Mars Committee to study Mars this year when Mars came so close to Earth. They may need that as a springboard to announce something about life from other worlds. The scientists who are on the Mars Committee now are in disagreement amongst themselves. That's why they say they're not letting out their information. However, Dr. Percy Wilkins, fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society in England, has announced that he saw the canals distinctly. There's no dispute about the canals. They do exist. Now, I am used to be a little disgusted in a way about the government not letting this thing out, but after all, I think they had quite a hot potato to handle. I mean, let's put ourselves in their position. It's not very easy to announce such a thing because there's so many philosophical ramifications and other implications. I believe myself that they have been educating the people of the United States for several years now too softly. One moment an article will be sort of anti-saucer, the next minute pro-saucer. That way, they get us to think. And they get us to talk. Through controversy, they get meetings such as this going, and they get people to talk. And of course, Americans are great talkers anyway. So that way, we'll learn more about the sausage. I had something else in my mind that I was going to talk to you about, and it just slipped my mind. Maybe it will come up during questions and answers. It had something again to do with the changes. But I would like to say again that our weather is warming up. Many people throughout this area and so on have said, well, the winters are getting milder and so on. But eventually there will be tropical, a tropical climate through this area. Now, before we have the question and answer period, I'd like to say we have two guests tonight which I would like to introduce. First of all, from Columbus, Ohio, as a fellow saucer lecturer here, who I'd like to stand up and have him stand up and take a bow. He's going to be lecturing tomorrow at Lancaster, Ohio. Isn't that right, Jack? Jack Grant from Columbus. Another young fellow who is known to some of you folks here in Cleveland, who I was in contact with and became a friend of sometime before we made radio contact in August of 1952 in Arizona. He's done quite a bit in saucer work since 1952 and now has the Saucer Roundup column in Mystic Magazine, which I'm sure some of you have been reading. Tom Camello from Shaker Heights. So if we could have a few minutes pause now, 4 or 5 minutes circulation, and then we'll have questions and answers. If you'll ask questions, it won't be too involved, so we don't have to spend too long on one question. Yes, sir. The question is, I'll repeat this too for the recorder. The question is, the basis of our radio contact, is that in International Morse? I'm sorry that I didn't mention that. Yes. It was International Morse. One time, voice was used or radio telephone. But that was only one time. I'd also like to add that I know now in several different states, and also in Michigan, that radio contacts are being made almost constantly by radio telephone or voice. No longer is code being used. Also, the government has a project in at Edwards Air Force Base in California, known as Project NQ-707, which is radio communication with saucers, in an attempt to get them to land. They're trying to get them to land in the Salton Sea area or in the Winter Peak area in California. Whether they've had success, I don't know, but that project does exist. Yes, sir. Well, that's a very good question. The gentleman asked, there are quadrillions of planets in space. Why is our particular one being singled out to be policed or to be watched or guided or something? I believe that the answer to that is that these people say that they, as far as they have surveyed in space with their own craft, they have always found planets and human beings wherever they have gone. That our Earth, not being the lowest in progression, but certainly not being the highest, in this particular section of the universe that they've surveyed and that they know about, this planet is the only one knowing war. On this planet, we are the only ones that kill our fellow man. The others do not. Another reason why this one is being singled out is, of course, I'm going to get into that, I hope to. Usually the questions bring us right into the next part of my lecture, but the reason they have singled us out is because the cosmic ray bombardment will change man mentally and spiritually. His mind will open because of this cosmic bombardment. If his mind doesn't open, he eliminates himself, which I'm going to discuss a little later. But they are here mainly to show us that truly the universe is one. They once stressed the fact that the universal mind of all men, and they want deity stressed. Not meaning God necessarily, but deity as the law, as universal law, because we are the planet that needs it. Yes, sir. The question is, do I define interstellar space as the space within the solar system or outside of our solar system, or just what do I mean? Well, by, of course, interstellar means from star to star, so it actually is beyond our own solar system. I mean, the term is means from star to star. The question is, if these people are so anxious to help us, why don't they land and assist us? Well, they will do that, but in time. You know, it's just like the old question that people used to ask, well, if there is a God and he's all-loving, why doesn't he stop war? People are now saying, if the saucers are here to help, why don't they stop? Well, this is their answer. First of all, we cannot have true peace by putting a gun in a man's back and forcing him to be peaceful. They say that our idea that peace is for the strong is inaccurate and a fallacy. That we only have peace if we learn to have peace. Therefore, they cannot interfere and force us to do anything, because then we are not truly learning anything. Just as if the children in the eighth grade would go down and disturb the third grade because they're not in the eighth grade and they're going to upset their lessons and so on. You can't do that. Neither can you get to the fourth grade who you say to the third grade. If you have to take it over 10 times, you're going to get it. You can't go to the fourth grade till you get to the third grade. Therefore, they say there are a lot of things that they can't interfere with here because of universal law. They can't force us to do anything. Only, they will assist only as we ask them to. They said, many people say, well, why did you have an experience? Are you something special, or why didn't I have something? Now, the answer to that is, they say, we do not choose you, you choose us. They are not going around Earth looking for a Republican or a Democrat or a good nation or a man who doesn't smoke or drink or because a man's skin is of a particular color. They're not interested in those things or what you particularly think. That's your own business. They say that they do not smoke and they do not drink in their particular world as we do, but if we want to do it, it's our own body and that's up to us. But in the overall picture of the thing, they're not too concerned because they say life is eternal and one body is only one overcoat, and we take them off and put them on, that the various planets are only houses in the Father's mansion. As Christ said, in my Father's house are many mansions. That each planet is a classroom where man learns certain lessons. He comes here for certain pleasure, pain experiences. When he has learned those things, no matter how many times he has to repeat the lesson, he eventually gets it before he goes to the next grade. Yes.
Well, in quadrillions of worlds, that would be hard to answer. The question is, if we are not the lowest, where are we?
Well, in space, they say, there are worlds, they say, that they know of, they have heard of. When they gave one example, where men are still running around with clubs, where in one particular world, they just discovered the wheel and an axle, and they discovered if they put beeswax on the axle, it lasted longer. Now, there are worlds like that, but in our particular section, in this area of the universe, whatever that might mean, I'm only telling you what they say. They say we are the only one knowing war. The others are more highly advanced than we are. We who thought we were so great, and I think it goes back to the time of Copernicus when the people were awfully angry because he said that the Earth was going around the sun and that the sun wasn't going around the Earth. In fact, they'd like to burn him at the stake. And some other scientists, they did burn him at the stake for saying that the Earth is not the center of the universe. It's the same thing now. People do not like to think that there is anything smarter in outer space than they are. It reminds me of my lecture with Truman Bethlehem in Cincinnati when a very well-known newspaper woman there came up and said, you know, I can go through this whole thing and all that. But she said, about this power and about this advancement, she says, I know within me very definitely that when a saucer is made, America will do it. Frank, I think that's nice, that's very patriotic, and it's very nice. We love our country, and we like to think that we are ahead in all these things, and we assist the world, but nevertheless, there are a lot of worlds out there, and there are a lot of things could be happening. Even Dr. Shipley at Harvard has said there are quadrillions, perhaps a quadrillion worlds in space that could contain life as ours does.